Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Graffiti-covered industrial concrete ruins are all that remain today to remind us of the lives, adventures, and human relationships that once animated Bower, Utah. Located just south of Tooele, across the Ochre Mountains, west of Salt Lake Valley, Bower was abandoned in 1979 and declared a toxic waste site. Stephen Lottridge's The Book of Bower, Stories from a Forgotten Town, brings it back to life, evoking mid-20th century family and community in that company town as seen through the eyes of an observant adolescent boy. Presenting in that snapshot of life in Bower, a narrative autobiographical form, the book recalls the fate of hundreds of derelict mining towns throughout the mountain sagebrush west. We'll revisit our conversation with Stephen Lottridge from March following this news. Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Graffiti-covered industrial concrete ruins are all that remain today to remind us of the lives, adventures, and human relationships that once animated Bower, Utah. Located just south of Tooele, across the Ochre Mountains, west of Salt Lake Valley, Bower was abandoned in 1979 and declared a toxic waste site. Stephen Lottridge's The Book of Bower, Stories from a Forgotten Town, brings it back to life, evoking mid-20th century family and community in that company town as seen through the eyes of an observant adolescent boy. Presenting a dramatic snapshot of life in Bower in narrative autobiographical form, the book recalls the fate of hundreds of derelict mining towns throughout the mountain and sagebrush west. Stephen S. Lottridge is author of Three White Pelicans, Stories for Stephanie and Deirdre, and The Old Bison, Threads from the Fabric of Western Life. His award-winning play Gun Control was produced by Riot Act, Inc. Theater Company. His poetry and essays appeared in print journals, anthologies, and online. And Stephen Lottridge joins us for the program today. Stephen Lottridge, thank you for joining us.
Absolutely, Tom. Thank you for having me.
So you live in Jackson now? This point?
I do.
By the way, growing up in Utah, I noticed Jackson Hole. Have we dropped the hole?
Well, Jackson Hole is the area, and okay. Jackson is the main town. And I happen to live in the town of Jackson, but we can say Jackson Hole because I live in that too.
Okay. All right. Well, that clears it up. I wish I had talked to you 20 years ago. All right. So this is a fascinating book. And as you write in your prologue, Bower is emblematic of many towns across the West. This one happened to be declared a toxic waste site. But other towns are, swallowed up by reservoirs or swallowed up by expansion of cities. This has happened a lot.
Right. Indeed, it has. Yeah. Actually, two of the towns I lived in as a very small boy are also now gone. One, as I said in the epilogue, was named, ironically, Manhattan, Nevada. And it consisted of a few tent houses. It was smaller even than Bower. And I tried to find it, and it's just disappeared. And then there was a little town of Germania in East Washington, and that has been swallowed up by Spokane.
I want to get into Bower, of course, but the epilogue, you paint a bit of a picture of your family, just one snapshot from that. You mentioned Manhattan. I think it's there that you mentioned several houses. This is the 30s.
Right.
You had the potbelly stove, and your parents would warm that up to glowing, right?
Right.
Wonderful. But then in the morning, everything's covered in frost, and your wet diaper is frozen.
That's right. I of course don't remember that, but my mother told me that story several times.
But your mother, who your father grew up kind of in a rural setting, your mother did not, but she apparently took to the West in these rural settings.
She did. Somehow she had such a spirit of adventure. I mean, she grew up in the Flatbush section of Brooklyn and lived all her life in cities in New York. She was living in Schenectady when she met my father. And so she had never been West. Her father had when he was a young man, but that was long before she was born. So it was that spirit of adventure that she had that she never wanted to go back.
And so she, you know, you see the favorite photograph of her smiling, holding a rifle. She took to rifles, I guess, fishing, the whole nine yards.
She did. Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is really remarkable because she retained a slight Brooklyn accent till the end of her life, which used to mortify me when I was a little boy in Bower, among other places, because it was pronounced to my ear. But her nature took to the West, and she never had any inclination to move back.
We'll leave some of the family history to a little later. You do in the book. You recount this in the epilogue. How did your family come to live in Bower? You only lived there for about a year, right?
That's right, for just almost exactly a year, from about third week in August of 1950 to the third week in August of 1951. The thing is, my father had lost his job up in northern Idaho, and so we were on the move, and there was a national, I think probably international, mining convention in Salt Lake City. And so he went down there looking for a job. We all came with him, sold the house up in Idaho, and he eventually took a job with Pioche Mines Company that was planning to set up a manganese refinery in Henderson, Nevada. But he needed to train for that, and they weren't ready for about a year until they were ready to finance it and set it up. So we were, as I say in the book, living on pretty meager finances, but they had a house that we could live in rent-free in Bower, and that's how we happened to move to Bower.
Bower, as you write, had been, it had been founded by soldiers who got into mining in the 1860s?
That's my understanding from the history I've read. There were soldiers stationed in Stockton, just kind of at the end of and after the Civil War, and they set up a mining operation in what then became Bower. It was a lead mine to begin with, and some other minerals perhaps, but mainly a lead mine.
This was a company town, Bower.
It was absolutely a company town. It was built specifically to house people who worked in the mine or in the plant that was adjacent to the mine.
At a certain point, these mining companies, as you write, came to use the surroundings as an unregulated dumping grounds, to the point where you say you never turned on your faucet, couldn't use the water, couldn't drink it anyway.
You couldn't drink it and you couldn't cook with it. We risked showering with it. We'd keep our eyes closed and our mouths closed and soak by
Wow.
And it was foul water, and so everybody in town had their water trucked in these big 50-gallon cans.
And you write that you were careful with that water, and it didn't spill a drop. That was your drinking water.
It was our drinking water and our cooking water, and it had to last till the next delivery. I think it came in twice a week.
You also say that this wasn't, in one sense, it wasn't a real town. It didn't have, theaters or grocery stores or, anything like that.
No, it had no amenities whatsoever. For some of the miners and some of the administration at the plant and at the mine, there was a boarding house where people could get breakfast or lunch, and the local rancher's wife ran the boarding house, but it wasn't a rooming house.
So the last residents left 1979. Of course, this is years in the future from when you're living here. But eventually, I guess, Bower ceased to be a town.
That's right. And what I've heard, I actually have there's a story in there called Mr. Bunn's Horses. And through sheer chance, I have made contact with his younger daughter. And she talks about growing up there and until she was 12 years old. But I'm sorry, I kind of lost track of your question.
I was just saying that it's quite poignant you know, that these towns live for a time and then they die. In this case, go ahead.
Yeah. There's no natural reason for them to be there. So they're entirely dependent on whatever industry built them to house workers. And so there was no spring water, there was no river, it wasn't a communication hub in any way. And so it wasn't even on the railroad, which ran from Twilla to Stockton.
So once it died, it was ordered, a toxic waste site. Last residents left 1979. I guess they put a gate over that, but you can't keep people out. I don't know if people still go there, but people would go there.
Well, you know, Tom, what I've heard, Paula Bunn, the woman that I got in touch with, said that she has a cousin who is in the sheriff's department in Grantsville, and he said that it is now the Twilla County dump.
Ah, okay, that's where it's ended up.
Yeah, that's what I've heard. But I haven't been. The last time I was there, the gate had been just kind of torn aside, and the ruins were there, but it was filled with graffiti and trash and rubble.
So you write, I just want to read this from this, quoting from Stephen Lotrich in his book, The Book of Bauer. All towns at the Superior own a history, not just of dates, data, and decline, but of lives lived. And no place dies completely as long as it exists in vivid memory. And so that's what you're doing here. You're recounting this year that you lived. You're about 14 years old, right?
Right. Go ahead.
So tell me a bit about what I'll have you read some passages from the book. Maybe just beginning. What was it like in general? A 14-year-old boy. You're living in this town. What was it like?
Well, it was a shock, to tell you the truth. I had never lived in my memory, although I started out in the sagebrush west in Nevada. I had never lived in my memory anywhere except up in the evergreen forests of the far northern Idaho panhandle, so in the Bitterroot Mountains. So just topographically, it was a shock. I had never been in that kind of desert before, in that kind of dry country before, with that much open land in front of you before. And the other thing was, I'd never ridden a school bus before. I had never lived in a place that was primarily socially kind of controlled by the LDS Church, by Mormons, and so I didn't really know anything about that. And so, and at 14, I was just coming into puberty and beginning to experience all those hormonal changes that a boy or a girl experiences at that time. So, but our family had always, my mother's adventuresomeness and my father's spirit of adventure had really infected the whole family. So we simply looked around for what we could do, what we could find. And our family was probably tighter in some ways that year than any other year because we children didn't have any social activities or athletic activities outside the way we had in other towns and the way we later did in other towns. So we were thrown on our own resources, and that was very interesting and in some ways very gratifying too.
You had older sister, younger brother, right?
That's right. Very close in age. My sister was 12 and a half months older than I, and my brother was 22 months younger.
You'd bus to school in Twilla, which is not too far away, right? And I guess shop in Twilla as well.
And shop in Twilla. Yeah, that was the closest town with food stores in it.
Yeah. Well, the book, a lot of adventures for a 14-year-old boy here out in this, edge of the West Desert. maybe you could read a passage for us. Is there a passage you'd like to select?
Well, I don't know. Would you suggest one?
I've got a little bit later here in the book. It's a story called "Seeing If I Could Kill My Father."
Oh yes,
which really, really struck me. page 91.
Okay.
If you get there, so to set this up, your father, I think he'd be in Salt Lake sometimes, but he'd be out in Bower, of course.
And it was on weekends. He'd be out in
Bower on weekends. You start this story talking about Oedipal issues,
right?
And then the first full paragraph on 91. Then if you go over the page and read the first paragraph on the next page, you challenge your father to a wrestle.
Right, I do. And setting it up, as you know from having read it, is because he went to Salt Lake and because of his losing his job in northern Idaho, and because I was hitting adolescence and being more interested in the wider world, I had always been his favorite. I was the elder son, and I had really lost touch with him. And the strife between my mother and father had made it difficult for me to kind of stay connected to him. And so I think I wasn't quite sure who was the boss of the family. And so here's the shot. You want me to read page 91 and then the first paragraph of 92?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. We're out wrestling in the yard. We locked eyes. His reddened face paled, then blotched white and crimson. His rib cage compressed under my pressure. I was panting with effort, and the hard earth roughing my back and nape as I strained. He reared back slightly, lifted my torso and head off the ground, and thumped them down. Not hard, but a clear warning. Dust rose around me, acrid with the scent of desiccated cottonwood leaves and twigs. Our combat transpired in utter silence, save for my panting, his increasingly shallow and stertorous breathing, and the thud of my skull and body rhythmically striking the ungiving ground. The harder I constricted, the higher he lifted me. The more sharply he dropped me, the more severely it hurt. Our battle had turned serious. We were no longer playing. I was struggling to overcome him, to force him to submit. He strove to teach me an unforgettable lesson. Endurance and fortitude marked my character, but before long I realized that I was losing. Anger and determination, touched by surprise and fear, showed in his stare. Perhaps to save some face, after all, I had initiated this battle. I pushed on for a few more seconds, but my father's shallow, desperate breathing began to frighten me. The unremitting thumping made my head ache without pause. My legs, in their vice grip, began to weaken and cramp. Dead dust and dead leaves puffed from the sides of my trunk as my father slammed it down. I raised a hand to signal a stop and unhooked my ankles. My legs fell away from my father's sides, and he rocked back, sweat pasting the twisting strands of his hair to his balding scalp. Our eyes, his bloodshot now, still met. Our breathing gradually eased as I lay and he knelt, leaning back on his heels. We had still not spoken, but our battle had satisfied something in both of us.
Yeah, that's quite the passage. You go on to say this episode in some way reassured your father. He had worried that you might not make it in this masculine world. You'd prove something to your father here.
That's exactly right. He was, although I was athletic and outdoorsy, I was very much a reader to books. My childhood goal, besides being a cowboy and an adventurer, was to be a painter. And so those things really came from my mother's side, but he worried that I wouldn't be a man's man. And so I think this fighting reassured him, even though it kind of dismayed him because it had turned serious. And I think many adolescent boys of a kind of academic, artistic bent with fathers who are very kind of vigorous outdoor people, and my father was an engineer, not an artist, experienced that.
Let's take a break. We'll come back, talk much more about this book. It's called The Book of Bower, Stories from a Forgotten Town. We're talking about Bower, Utah, near Tooele. Last residents lived there in 1979. It was declared a toxic waste site, a mining town, company town. And Stephen Lottridge is the author. He and his family lived there for 1 year. And these stories are from that year in Bower. We're talking about The Book of Bower. We'll have more following this break. Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're talking with the writer Stephen Lottridge. He is author most recently of Book of Bower, The Book of Bower, Stories from a Forgotten Town. We're talking about Bower, Utah. It's near Tooele, and it's now abandoned. Last residents lived there in 1979. It was a mining town. It was declared eventually a toxic waste site. And Stephen Bower and his family lived there when he was about 14 in the 1950s. So some fun stories, poignant stories here, all about this year that they lived in Bower. This coming of age, right? You're around 14 in these stories, must have had a big effect on you, because it only 1 year in this town, yet you've got several stories here.
Well, that's true, and there are probably others that I haven't thought of. It was a powerful year for me. Emotionally, it felt almost like we had launched ourselves from this little cocoon we'd been living up in far northern Idaho, where I figured we'd just stay until I went to college, if I did go to college. And so also at that time, as I said earlier to you, I was in full bloom of puberty and. Hormonally, it was a very intense time, and physically and geographically. I mean, there had been so many changes that I think that year has always stuck very firmly in my mind.
Well, maybe that's a nice segue to. I'd like to have you read a passage from a story called "Not Kissing Carol Drewby Goodnight." So this kind of gives you a little piece of yourself, you know, the hormones raging, but also your mother. And she seems like a very strong-willed woman, your mother.
She was indeed.
Yeah. So I wonder if you'd, page 33, just the bottom paragraph,
and then
read all of page 34 and then the first couple of paragraphs of 35.
Okay. So I'm walking Carol Drewby home after my sister's birthday party, which was something of a dud. Carol Drewby and I started up the wide dirt path between the road and the row of houses. We walked apart. We had passed the place where, earlier that month, a giant bull snake had come boiling out of the brush in our overgrown yard, writhed almost across my feet. I had heard the rush of its body weaving and thrashing through the dry leaves and vines before it broke into view just in front of me. Its pale, thick body seemed to pass forever, thwacking little stones and twigs aside in its passage. It hissed loudly and aggressively, raising its head toward me as it whipped by. The prospect that it might swing back and attack terrified me. I told Carol Drewby about it. She replied that she had seen such snakes, too, and that they scared her and that her father had killed one once. After that exchange, conversation faltered. We quickly reached her house. I drew the gate back for her chivalrously. We climbed the 3 chipped cement steps to her lighted side porch. As a gentleman, I needed to see her safely in, but she delayed opening the door, so we chatted briefly. The chill had increased, and I wanted to get home. The idea that she wanted me to kiss her goodnight did occur to me. The porch was tiny, a 4x4 concrete slab, so we were standing close together. She didn't attract me. In any way, I wouldn't have known how to go about it if I had wanted to caress her. So I redirected the moment. I reached for the screen door handle, opened the door partway, and thanked her for coming to the party. She pulled the door wide, twisted the inside knob, and thanked me for walking her home. I said goodbye, hopped down the stairs, and left. I walked home through the dark autumn night, breathing the acrid smell of dry cottonwood leaves and arid earth, relieved by a duty scrupulously fulfilled, and watching for bull snakes, and eager to get to the warmth of my house and bed with maybe another piece of birthday cake along the way.
And then it closes this passage. You
oh, shall I read on?
read the the next paragraph.
Instead, with maybe another piece of birthday cake along the way, instead, I ran smack into the tornado of my mother's wrath. "Did you kiss Carol Drooby goodnight?" she repeated, her voice raised and eyes flashing.
Now, it turns out she wouldn't have wanted you to, I guess, because Carol Drooby, in her view, didn't behave herself at the party.
That's right. In her view, she somehow acted as if it were her birthday party. According to my mother, I didn't notice any of that.
Right. So this was interesting. Some girls from Tooele, I guess, came in. Some girls from Bower. Was there any division in the, kind of the social structure there, or does everybody feel comfortable with each other?
The division in the social structure was people were friendly, but Carol Drooby and my sister Donna were. They were outsiders. The girls who came from Tooele knew each other socially. They knew each other from school. They knew their families knew each other, and everybody knew each other. And they were all dressed alike, and they brought very similar presents with similar wrappings. They knew each other. They tried, but they ended up, of course, talking to each other rather than to my sister or rather than to Carol Drooby. And Carol Drooby and my sister, while they were in the same class, were not really friends. This was only about 2 weeks into school, and so or maybe a month into school. And so my sister really hadn't got to know anybody closely.
So this particular party was a dud, I guess.
The party was a dud. And this was the first time and the only time, first and last time, that my mom held a birthday party for one of us children. That we always celebrated, and we celebrated well, but we celebrated strictly within the family.
Yeah, the first and last time. Wow. Tell me about some of the other things you got up to. There's one story in the book where you almost set the town on fire.
Yes, my brother had found out that if you put together a little bunch of cottonwood cotton and strike a match to it, it looks like it just magically disappears. You really don't see much, if any, flame. And so he induced me to join him in lighting these little piles on fire. And the problem was that we got a little bit incautious, and he struck a match and set some on fire that was under the cottonwood trees, and then it gradually spread and went over into our neighbor's yard, Mr. Perks's yard. And we got in a panic because there was cottonwood cotton all the way over to his house, and while there was a cinder block foundation over these old wooden siding just above it. And so but we managed to get it out in time. But he came home while we were fighting this conflagration, which wasn't really a huge conflagration, but it was a very fast-moving, low fire, and we couldn't really tell where it was to stop it. But then I found a hose in his yard that worked, and I was able to fight back the flames. And then it also ran out of fuel. Anyway, I just had catastrophic images of all of these rickety old wooden houses going up.
Yeah, you were lucky there, I guess. Yeah,
we were lucky. We were lucky, and interestingly, as I say in the story, it kind of almost broke the ice with Mr. Perks. He was very friendly with us after that.
Earlier in the program, you talked about this was quite the shift for you in terms of landscape.
Yes.
I guess you came to adapt to that. You talk about, you know, snakes and, you know, adapting this land, a lot of playing out there in essentially the desert.
Yeah. We did. We were, it turns out, pretty adaptable people. And I don't know whether it's because my mother and father had adapted from New York to the West and kind of modeled adaptation. But we did, and there was, you know, Tom, it was a kind of childhood that's very rare now. In that town, in that time, and also even when we lived in northern Idaho, kind of you went out and played for hours, and you were just supposed to come home for lunch or come home for supper or check in occasionally, but you weren't. It was not organized activity. You made up games and with other kids or by yourself. And so it's a kind of childhood that has a freedom in it and an exploration and adventure in it that I think is relatively rare now.
Did you make friends here? Were you able to make friends?
Well, I did. It was a not exactly a friendship, but with Mr. Bunn, the local rancher, we had a very nice relationship because he wanted us to ride his horses, which we did. In Twila, at school, I made a couple of friends, especially one named Dennis Long. He and I had a number of classes together, and we sat together in algebra, and the teacher spent the class just having us solve problems together. We were supposed to have a partner, and so Dennis and I did that. And he was the one that invited me to join the Eagle Scouts, not realizing that I was not a Mormon.
Yeah, there's a story called Why I Did Not Become an Eagle Scout, but How I Did Get Invited to the Ninth Grade Prom. So that's good.
Yes.
So tell me about that. You mentioned this earlier in the hour as well. You move into an area which is, I guess, predominantly, at that point, members of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints?
Yes, yes. It was a very strongly LDS town, and the people in Bower I didn't really know, but most of them, the ones that I did know about their religious affiliations, they were LDS, and they would go to church in Twila. And almost all of the people that the kids I met in school were LDS, and they were in mutual, and they went with their families to church. And as I describe in that story, the Eagle Scout group was sponsored by and limited to members of the LDS Church, Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And I got interested in that religion during that year and continued to be interested in it for a number of years afterwards. But, of course, there's limited entree unless you begin to actively participate and express a desire to become a Mormon. Mm.
So was there a barrier there? Were you able to overcome that, you know, between the two, you know, cultures, essentially, right? Besides being religions, kind of two cultures.
Well, it is two cultures, and thank you for the question, Tom. That's a very interesting one, because my experience was that there was not much of an initial barrier at all, that it was kind of soft. The kids I knew and the adults I knew who were LDS, they were friendly, they were nice, they were, you know, we were a pretty clean-cut family, and so in some ways we had the same standards that the LDS Church has of, you know, no drinking, no smoking, no full-on sex before marriage, things like that. And so I kind of naturally had an affinity for it, but then you would kind of hit this soft barrier where you suddenly realized that you were not invited to something that all of the people you were talking to were invited to, or that something like the Eagle Scout troop, where the meeting was actually at 8 o'clock, he had told me it was at 7 o'clock, but 7 o'clock was then when there was a mutual meeting. And I was ready to go to mutual. But it turns out you don't just do that. Mm-hmm. And so what I experienced was, on the surface, and not just superficial, but on the surface, great friendliness, great acceptance. I was never shunned in the idea, if we had stayed there, of playing sports or participating in school social groups or things like that. But there was a barrier a little way in that was soft but very firm.
Mm-hmm. I want to have you read one more passage, then we'll take a break, and then I'd like to maybe kind of move to what you guys got up to afterwards. So this is, let's see, page 126.
Okay.
126. You're talking about your dog, Sporty.
Okay, hold on a second.
So 126.
Right.
And to kind of set this up, we'll leave this for the people to read the book, that an intense scene where a friend sixes German Shepherd on Sporty, and Sporty makes short work of that German Shepherd. But I wanted to read a kind of more, have you read a kind of more poignant passage, starting about halfway down, that vital warrior, that paragraph there on page 126.
Okay, and just that.
And then over and read page 127.
So. Okay. That vital warrior had faded as he aged. His hearing and sight, once so acute, failed him. When we left Idaho, my parents kenneled him until we landed in Utah and sent for him. That long month of separation from the only family he had known since he had been 6 weeks old stunned him. The dog who arrived in a crate one weekday afternoon bore little resemblance to the companion I had grown up with. I climbed down from the school bus on that warm September afternoon to find my mother sitting in a steel lawn chair. The shaved, trimmed, clean spaniel beside her sat silent, like a statue in an advertisement. "Who is that?" I asked. I wondered for the first few seconds if she had gotten a new pet for some reason. She smiled knowingly and nodded at the animal beside her while I stood in confusion. She knew how much I loved sport, so with another nod she finally said, "That's Sporty. Don't you recognize him? He's your dog." I dropped my books and went to my knees beside him, my arms outstretched. He did not respond either to my voice or to my caresses. After a long pause, my mother said gently, "He's been through a lot, Steve. Let's just give him some time. He'll come back to himself." And indeed he did, to the aged 12-year-old self that he had become. His fur grew out and his enthusiasm returned. The disinfectant smell from the kennel faded away and his gamey outdoor odor replaced it. But his compromised faculties betrayed him. He smashed into sagebrush and tumbled into gullies he could not see. When he did not hear our calls and searched frantically for us when we were downwind in the fields, but his zest for adventure and love for his family filled his hearty being once more and for the last time. We were Christian Scientists and believed in the healing power not so much of prayer to God as of knowing the truth of the perfection of all beings. When my mother said she was working for him, this was when he was dying, she meant she was reading the scriptures and Christian Science texts to assert that healing truth. In her mind, she stood on solid ground, not just because of her faith, but also because she credited herself with having brought him back from death once before.
So, that's wonderful. It gives you a sense of sport. You call him Sport or Sporty?
We called him alternatively. I mean, it could be either one, but mostly kind of when you're just referring to him casually and affectionately as Sporty, when you're referring to him as my dog Sport. That's what we called him.
And I guess that's a rite of passage, right? Adolescent boy with his dog. It must have been quite a blow when he died.
It was a terrible blow. I was, as I say in the story, I think he was very attached to my mother. She fed him and had raised him when he was little. That was before I was capable of having much to do with him. But I was the one that was most affectionate with him and that played with him the most and cleaned his doghouse. And my brother and sister would be, when he was with us in the back seat of the car, they would take exception to his crawling around on them and expelling gas on them and things like that. And I just loved him all the way. Mm-hmm. No question, no reservations.
Yeah, that's wonderful. You say you were a Christian Scientist, especially your mother, right? And I had wondered earlier in the story when she said she was working for him, but you explained it there in that passage. It's a Christian Scientist phrase, I guess.
It is a Christian Scientist phrasing, and it's interesting. My mother had come across Christian Science shortly before she met my father, and she introduced him to it, and they became very, very active practitioners and active in the church. And that faded away eventually in Anderson for some reason when we moved to Nevada. But it was very, very central in our lives. And the behavior that Christian Science asks, as I said before, is very similar to the behavior that the LDS Church asks of its members.
Mm. Let's take another break. When we come back, I want to spend a little time in the epilogue, what you guys got up to after these scenes, after this 1 year in Bower. We're talking about the Book of Bower, Stories from a Forgotten Town. The author is Stephen Lottridge. This book is out now and available from University of Utah Press. Some wonderful stories here. About a year in the life of Stephen Lottridge and his family when he was about 14, lived in this mining town, which was abandoned in 1979. We'll have more following this.
This episode of Access Utah was originally broadcast in March.
You're listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're talking with Stephen Lottridge. His latest book is called The Book of Bower, Stories from a Forgotten Town. It's a year in the 1950s that he and his parents, brother and sister, lived in this mining town, Bower, near Tooele. And that town eventually died, declared a toxic waste site. Last residents lived there in 1979. So, Stephen Lottridge, this is a snapshot from your boyhood. We've had you tell some stories. Tell us a little bit about what you guys got up to after this. I think you went on to Henderson?
We went on to Henderson, which at the time I lived there from 51 to 54, was a separate town of about 12,000 people, about 11 or 12 miles southwest of Las Vegas. It's now been completely swallowed up by Las Vegas. But it was a separate town. That was Mojave Desert. That was, if I had thought that around Tooele was desert, it was kind of rock and creosote bushes in the Mojave Desert. And so that was even more of a shock. It was also very, very hot. So my dad did set up that manganese refinery. We lived there for 3 years, which was my sophomore, junior, and senior year of high school. And we played sports and were active socially and, again, made the best of things. Used to hike in the desert and go down to Lake Mead to go swimming and stuff like that. But then at the end of 1954, that August, my father's job was complete. The manganese refinery was completely set up and running very well. He'd done his job, and he was recalled by the company to Salt Lake City. So I set off for college. My sister had set off for college a year before me, and my mother and father and brother moved to Salt Lake, and they lived on this in this little tiny kind of half-basement, mostly basement apartment, up near East High School on the hill. And it was very hard for them. And eventually my parents separated, and my mom went back down to Henderson and took my brother with her, and he had a highly successful academic and athletic career down there in his the end of his junior year and then his senior year. And my dad lived from 1954 till he died in 1983 in Salt Lake City. My mom moved around, and my sister moved to New York with a guy she married and lived there for the rest of her life. And my brother and I moved all over the place and ended up here and there. So it's almost like this tight family we'd had to begin with suddenly just came apart like shooting stars here and there, and we landed in different places.
You ended up served in the Navy, right?
Right. I served in the Navy for 3 years on a aircraft carrier out of San Diego. And then I went to graduate school at Columbia in New York City. And after a year in studying at the University of Moscow in Russia, the Soviet Union, I came back and taught at Northeastern universities from 65 to 79.
Professor of Slavic languages and literature at
various
universities. Yeah. Then I was reading an article from the paper in Jackson, where later in life you decided to make a career change, became a clinical psychologist.
That's correct. Yeah. Yeah. I got very interested in clinical psychology. Made the career change when I was living in Massachusetts, around Cambridge. But then I'm a Westerner. I lived a long time in the Northeast, and it was very gratifying because I taught at really good colleges and stuff, but I was driving up the Central Artery through Boston one time to get to my job, and I thought, what am I doing? I got to get back to where there's some open space. And so I did. Came to Wyoming.
And you've been there, I guess, ever since. Huh?
I've been here since 1988, yeah.
Yeah. And then another, I guess, career turn, or maybe not career, but interest that you've had wanted to do, acting and writing.
That's right. That's right, Tom. I had, I think for all of us, there are kind of lives unlived that abut the lives we have lived in. So, and acting and writing were both ones that I hadn't lived in. So a little bit I had, but I acted for 12 or 15 years here with the professional theater company and with amateur theater companies, and had wonderful time doing that. And I also then, when I retired from being a clinical psychologist, when I closed my practice in 2013, I began to write seriously, and mostly memoir. I have a few. I'm actually working on a book of poems now. I'm trying to put that together. But that writing, I can remember when I was a little kid writing on graph paper, because that's what I had, and wanting to tell stories. So
yeah, that's you've been able to do most of what you wanted to do.
And I think I really feel blessed in that I've had enough life to have time to do it.
Well, it's been such a pleasure talking to you, Stephen Lottridge. The latest book is The Book of Bauer, Stories from a Forgotten Town. There's some other books out there as well. You could check out The Three White Pelicans and The Old Bison. And an award-winning play, Stephen Lottridge, Gun Control, It's produced by Riot Act Inc. Theater Company. I lives in Jackson, and this new book, Book of Bauer, is out and available now from University of Utah Press. Stephen Lotrus, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you very much, Tom. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you. And thanks, everyone, for listening to Access Utah. Yes, thanks for listening. And just a note here at the end, the Cache Valley Humanitarian Center has invited the community to an open house on Thursday, August 1st from 4 to 7 p.m. The center is temporarily located at the Riverwoods Complex at 595 South Riverwood Parkway in Logan. Refreshments will be served. Members of USU football, basketball, soccer, and volleyball teams will be joining guests and other Humanitarian Center volunteers. The open house welcomes area residents, summer citizens, business and government leaders to see how the Humanitarian Center has impacted Cache Valley in the 3 years since the center's founding. The center has worked with 40 nonprofits and area schools to provide nearly 10,000 individuals with a variety of needed items, back-to-school kits, hygiene kits, sleeping mats, coats, quilts, and books. And volunteers have donated 24,000 hours of their time gathering and producing the items. And the Humanitarian Center's board of directors says the center is in great need of a permanent home, and with your help, we hope to find one to continue our efforts to promote self-reliance, independence, and community-mindedness. So they're asking you to please join the Cache Valley Humanitarian Center on August 1st from 4 to 7 p.m. for an open house at the Riverwoods Complex. And for more information, you can go to cachevalleyhumanitariancenter.com.
You are listening to Utah Public Radio, a statewide service of Utah State University and the College of Humanities and Social Sciences. KUSR Logan, KUSK Vernal, KUSL Richfield, KUST Moab, KCEU Price, KUSU FM Logan, also heard at upr.org.